Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, listeners, imagine a vast circular prison. Okay, you with me?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you step inside and you'll find a curious arrangement of the cells, because most of this enclosed space is exactly that. It's empty space. The cubicle cells line the circumference of the inner walls, several stories worth, in fact, and their bars all face inward toward a lone guard tower known as the Inspector's Lodge. Okay? Now, standing within your prison cell, you can't see any of your fellow cellmates, can't see any of the other cells. All you can see is this tower. And you can't see the inspector that supposedly mans it due to a mesh screen. But you know he's there. You know he's watching.
Mm-hmm.
You know he's referencing a detailed map of which prisoner occupies which cell. Mm-hmm. And you know that he listens in as well. But, of course, the inspector can only look or listen to one cell at any given moment, right? But you never know if his attention is turned to you. So you have to assume at all times that he might be listening to you. You have to avoid that type 2 error in cognition. It's the only way to deal with the endless uncertainty. It's safer to assume, right? And besides, you know that prisoners are regularly moved to new cells based on good or bad behavior.
So I see that you have had a look inside my house.
Oh, is this how you have your house arranged?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're the inspector?
What makes it really easy to keep tabs on everybody.
Yeah.
So I think what you have just described is something called the panopticon.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about this today. We are going to look at how spaces can have the power to liberate, as we've talked about before with labyrinths,
mm-hmm.
or they have the power to oppress. And when you think about prison and you think about prisoners, you think about anxiety, loneliness, and vulnerability. And so this panopticon is really this idea of these concentric circles closing in on us.
Yeah, and what's great about it is that it's not only this wonderful and disturbing to varying levels design
mm-hmm.
for how we might use a physical space to have this drastic effect on the human mind, but it also over the years has been picked up as a philosophical idea, as a metaphor that we apply to government, to internet culture, you name it. I mean, you do a search for panopticon, you will find people using it just about every way they possibly can to criticize a given system of order, government, bureaucracy, etc.
Well, probably one of the oldest ways in which it's been linked is this metaphor of the seeing eye of God, right? Particularly in Western culture, because when you're indoctrinated into Western culture, you're indoctrinated into this idea that there's this, this powerful gaze and this powerful memory of a deity looking over all of us.
Yeah. He knows what you've been doing.
He knows when you've
been
bad.
He knows when you're awake. Yeah. Santa Claus and God are kind of kind of share the same space in the Western mindset. And you're right. To your point, the idea of the inspector in the inspector's lodge and that tower at the center of the Panopticon is very much the idea of a God, but a very, non-personal God, a God that's all up in your business, but also you have no real clue as to what they look like, what they are, what their ideas are regarding your fate in this strangely ordered prison.
Well, this is a vengeful God, and this is something that, you know, it came out of the mind of a English utilitarian philosopher by the name of Jeremy Bentham, who unveiled this architectural marvel, these plans for this panopticon to the world. So as you said, you know, let's revisit that again. We're talking about two sets of concentric towers, one within the other, with cells lining the outer wall being visible to and subject to regulation from the Watcher, the Eye of God. Mm-hmm. And those people, they would live, they would eat, they would sleep and work in these cells. And what they thought was constant surveillance.
Right. Now, to give you a little background, Jeremy Bentham lived 1748 to 1832. Again, he was a British philosopher and something of a political radical. He's mainly known for the philosophy of utilitarianism, which elevates actions based on their relevant consequences to the overall happiness of everyone affected. And he had something of a hedonistic approach to happiness, defining it simply as a matter of experiencing pleasure and a lack of pain. Now, when it comes to his panopticon, his approach to it was that this is an overall good idea. He wasn't saying, I have a great humanity-crushing concept I want to unveil on the world.
Yeah.
No, he was saying, look, prisons are a mess. We're in the midst of overall attempts to reform our prisons and make them more effective and make them less horrifying. So here's one way we can do it. And we can make it more cost-effective and overall just more effective as well.
Right, because if you have a couple of guards in a central tower watching over everyone, then you don't have guards that are going, you know, on the beat to every single cell and looking over, right? So you have less manpower that actually has to enforce this feeling that you're being surveilled.
Yeah, you end up with four guards that you're two of which are actually paid, because you have the two guys, you know, one guy maybe walking around, you have one guy in the tower, and then you have fear and uncertainty. And you don't have to pay for those, because those guys are summoned out of the very physicality of the structure.
Yeah, and it's actually compounded this fear by this idea of having those cells being illuminated, but the observation tower actually being dark, so that the prisoners could be observed at all times, but they wouldn't be able to tell when they were being observed. And so the goal is for them to learn to act as if they were constantly under surveillance. And the idea is that once this I guess you could call it self-discipline was instilled, that prisoners could be released into society with the capacity to regulate their own behavior through paranoia, really.
Yeah, really.
And Bentham, I mean, he's not trying to be dastardly about this. He's sort of thinking it's just the way that we can manage the prison problem and reform the prisoner via paranoia.
Exactly.
So originally he thought about this as a prison design, but he also thought it was, quote, applicable to any sort of establishment in which persons of any description are to be kept under inspection. So we're talking about insane asylums, poorhouses, but this is where it gets into society, factories, schools, and hospitals.
Yeah. I mean, without getting into the fine details of it, you can see where that would make sense in, a hospital environment, where you want constant surveillance, more or less, of people's conditions, or at the very least, you want people to feel like they're under constant care and surveillance. So that would make sense. And obviously, with a school situation, but sometimes it feels like a school is very similar to a prison or insane asylum, and you have to have that kind of order in place to make sure that everyone's doing right and obeying the laws of the school, not cheating on every test, not skipping classes.
The problem with this, and we'll get more into this in a bit, is this inherent distrust right? Because, okay, you see it extended to prisons, but factories, schools, and hospitals, it's not necessarily just taking the form of, hey, we're just going to surveil and make sure everything is okay. There's this idea that something is wrong. Someone somewhere is doing something wrong.
Right. Yeah. The whole system ends up being predicated on guilt and and assumed guilt. Yeah. All right. So anyway, you're probably asking yourself, you're saying, all right, well, where's the panopticon? Point to the panopticon so I might see a picture of it. And certainly there's some wonderful sketches of it because Bentham put a lot of thought and effort into the designs. He worked with an architect. He was even taught in talks to see his design implemented at one point, but the panopticon was never built in his lifetime. In fact, no true panopticon prison was ever built. In other words, no one ever took his designs and said, all right, I'm going to build this thing that he designed. Part of the problem here is that by the time surveillance technology really caught up with his vision, you no longer need that specific architecture to make it happen. Mm-hmm. Like once you can actually wire every prison cell conceivably with video and audio, if you reach the point where you can do that, you don't need this giant space with all this wasted empty space between the cells and the tower. You can just build a big, farm of cubes and then just wire it up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge cost, and politicians were interested, but they weren't necessarily going to implement it.
Yeah, and we see this all the time, even today. You know, you're always finding stuff showing up in your feed, your news feed, or your Facebook feed, where it's like some crazy design that's going to innovate the way that we travel or do business or live. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, you're not going to see those designs implemented. Those represent the extreme that, under the best of situations, will... you'll see aspects of that implemented further down the chain, or at least will draw inspiration and innovation in that direction.
Right. But so it was never truly built, but it still influenced other prisons.
Yes, and probably the best example that we can find for this is Cuba's Presidio Modelo. And this was built between 1926 and 1928. And it actually consists of five panopticon buildings, each designed to hold 2,500 prisoners. So these are five buildings, cells lining the inside of the outer walls. Mm-hmm. And then there's a tower in the center where the guards would be able to watch everyone. Mm-hmm. And it operated. It was functional. And you actually saw some star prisoners there. Fidel Castro was a prisoner there during the rebellion. And, then after his rise to power, you see the thing just stuffed with political prisoners, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, counter-revolutionaries, various enemies of the state. And, so the population quickly skyrockets to 6,000 inmates. Now, of course, that's the thing about prisons. If they're built to contain a certain number of people, if you overstuff them, you're going to overload any system. You're going to overload the wiring of the prison. And that's exactly what happened. You have overcrowding that leads to riots in 1961, and then it was permanently closed by the government in 1966. Today it's a museum, and I think there's a school there and also some offices. But for the most part, you can still find pictures of this online, and you can visit it if you're in Cuba. And it's really remarkable to look at because it's the idea of the panopticon brought to physical life.
I wanted to point out a quote by Architects, Designers, Planners for Social Responsibility. That's ADPSR. There is an essay on this about prisons and panopticon. And the quote is, "The best-intentioned reformist designs have believed that more complete control of prisoners through design would be used only to further higher goals, such as religious awakenings and inner reflection. But in fact, control is an end in itself. And prisons just recreate the powerlessness of the member of poor and oppressed groups under even stricter rules than they face on the outside." Now, that was something interesting to ponder, just in general. The panopticon is really this idealized version of power and control. But the prison system as it exists right now, there are many people who would say that it doesn't work. It doesn't reform.
I agree. And that's definitely a subject for another episode. We could do a whole episode on the state of prisons and the mindset that goes into prison designs overall. And just the philosophy that goes into it and how it's changed over time.
Indeed. So, well, let's take a quick break. And when we get back, we are going to look more at this panopticon from the perspective of Michel Foucault.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Jean, and Vlastar runs the business. I understand now. It is a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Jean! Run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes. That it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So, yes, that's the best example of the Panopticon. Physically that we have, and you do see panopticonic elements incorporated into various other prison designs. But for the most part, where panopticon continues to have the most power today is as metaphor.
That's right, and that's why I wanted to bring up that quote by the ADSPR, because Michel Foucault is a French philosopher who brought up the panopticon as this idea of a metaphor of our society, that our disciplinary systems, our prisons in particular, with a panopticon as the ideal type, they can be social failures.
Yeah, Foucault's picture of modern disciplinary society breaks down into three primary techniques mm-hmm. that governmental powers use to control the masses. That's hierarchical observation, normalizing judgment, mm-hmm. and examination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and where this panopticon enters into all that is that, according to Foucault, power over people can be achieved merely by observing them. So it's like with the panopticon. But the deal is that a single inspector would be impossible, right? Especially when you're talking about governmental power. So you need relays of inspectors. You need all of them arranged in a hierarchy so that data can pass up and down the chain based on importance. And in all of this, Foucault focused in on society's modern transition from a, quote, culture of spectacle to a carceral or prison culture. Now, this gets into the idea that what happened when you broke the law in the old days and broke it hard. You would be made spectacle of.
Right. And that's what he says. He says that, this is a quote for him, by the effect of backlighting, one can observe from the tower, standing out precisely against the light, the small captive shadows in the cells of the periphery. They are like so many cages, so many small theaters in which each actor is alone, perfectly individualized and constantly visible. So he's saying that this stage, the it's been reversed, that the audience is now in the cells. And the actor, the performer, is that watch person looking over everybody else.
Where,
and it still remains to spectacle, really.
Yeah. A reversal of the old days where mm-hmm. everyone would be gathered around the guillotine or the headsman's block or the noose or what have you.
So, yeah. And within those three points that you had made, the hierarchical distribution of information, examination of that information, but also normalizing. This is a really important aspect of this, and this is what a lot of people run with when they look at our society today and look at the different ways that panopticon can exist in different formats. So what Foucault has to say about normalizing, he says, hence the major effect of the panopticon to induce in the inmate a state of conscious and permanent visibility that assures the automatic functioning of power. So to arrange things that the surveillance is permanent in its effects, even if it is discontinuous in its action. Again, this is sort of going back to what Bentham was really saying, is trying to instill that paranoia that you're being watched, even if you're not being watched.
Yeah, they might be watching me, so therefore there's always this feeling that kind of evens out that they are watching me.
Yeah, and I'll just skip ahead in this quote. He says, in short, that the inmates should be caught up in a power situation of which they are themselves the bearer. So they are the bearer of this, and it's this normalization of always being under the gaze. And this is what Foucault had a problem with, because he said that, again, it's not just limited to prison design. It's a metaphor for all types of different social organizations and structures, schools, factories, and governments.
Now, Purdue University's Dino Feluga breaks down the effects of panoptic organizational models into seven overall effects. And I think these are pretty interesting. This, again, is his view and his commentary on Foucault's philosophy. Number one, society becomes less willing to contest unjust laws. Like, everyone's under the gaze mm-hmm. of the observer, and so therefore, even if the laws seem to be becoming unjust, you're less likely to speak out of them because the gaze is in theory on everyone. Number two, rehabilitation rather than crueler and unusual punishment. So again, we talked about that it becomes more about the prison system rather than the spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's birth of an information society. You become more and more dependent on technology and record keeping. You have a bureaucracy of information in which people become numbers, because again, you're having to keep track of everybody and keep track of everything in this panoptic system. Efficiency becomes more and more important, even at the cost of exploitation or injustice. And finally, specialization. Members of the workforce are organized into increasingly specialized fields so that we increasingly rely on other experts to complete tasks that had previously been shared or common knowledge. So, we're talking the preparation of meats and other food products, building construction, transportation, etc. His idea here is that with the panopticon, it kind of breeds bureaucracy, and bureaucracy is the brick and mortar of the governmental panopticon, the power panopticon that is society.
Yeah, and these unwritten rules, and this idea that you're being surveilled, this idea that it's all normal, right? You can start to look around, and as people have done, particularly at the drone situation, and say, okay, so what about the Panopticon in modern society? Well, start to think about how the Pentagon has scores of communication satellites, many of them for linking drones, ground troops, and imagery analysts. There are some 7,000 aerial drones compared with fewer than 50 a decade ago. Now consider that we increasingly have something called spy flies, which are equipped with sensors and micro cameras, and the fact that since September 11th, the hours the Air Force devotes to flying missions for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance have gone up 3,100%. And every day the Air Force processes 1,500 hours of full motion videos and another 1,500 still images, a lot of it from the Predator drones and Reapers. So that's one tiny aspect of surveilling power that exists in the world today.
And of course, in the past few months, the NSA has been all over the headlines for both its domestic surveillance programs and its international surveillance programs. And that, of course, is a really hot button topic as well, with critics charging that the NSA not only infringes on our privacy, but lays the technological groundwork for a true police state and is really just part of an overall panoptic structure on society.
Yeah, and the problem there is that legislation cannot keep up with technological advances. So you have these sort of things being rolled out, and if they are challenged, then it takes a while to actually get that policy in place or that law in place to sort of balance out what sort of surveilling power is needed to run a government versus what just becomes overwhelming.
Right.
And there's a huge debate about that right now. The other thing is that in a way, every time you use the internet, you are willingly submitting yourself to this panopticon. I mean, think about the humble cookie, right?
Right.
I mean, you're talking about this tiny little omniscient tendril of the internet that's gathering information about you. It's recording your internet browsing habits, and it's reporting them to a business that you know nothing about. So in a way, the corporation becomes the tower, you know, the central tower with the watchman, and we are in those little cubicles surrounding it with all of our information being passed on. And I'm not trying to be dramatic about it. It's just, if you really want to look at this system, this panoptic system, and look at it in the digital sphere, that's in essence how it's working.
Yeah, like I think of browsing the internet at work, which, I mean, in some places of work, that's already breaking the rules. Here, we do a lot of internet research, so it's part of our job.
Yeah.
But every time we conduct a search and go to a website here at work, there are like several layers of potential panopticonic thinking going on. First of all right, the cookies that are talking to my Facebook and to and to this site and this site, you know, to what degree am I being watched there? This site I just went to, all right, all these different corporations just found out about it. Next, I'm using a work machine on a work internet connection. I know that they have certain systems in place. I don't know the details of them or how they work, but I know that they can/are, you know, observing what I'm doing on my machine. And so it eventually becomes this situation of you feel like you're observed all the time. And what are you comfortable being observed doing? You know, you end up rationalizing, like, all right, I'm going to this website. I'm clearly going here for research. I have a good excuse when the inspector leaves the tower and comes to get me. Like that's the kind of weird thinking you're left in.
Yeah, because you assume you're being watched.
Yeah.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, It kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. I've lost all on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Now, to add to this, our other technological tchotchkes, advancements, however you want to swing it, I'm thinking about Google Glass. Because here some people would say, okay, here's this thing that is recording not only audio, but video of everything that's going around them. So now we have this idea of the panopticon as us gathering information about one another. And this does sound a little bit paranoid, but I think that the crux of this argument is if and when everyone is wearing Google Glass, then it becomes normalizing behavior to surveil people, even though you're not, you wouldn't call it surveilling, you know, your coworkers or your friends, but you are gathering data about them. And essentially, there is a third party that is using that data in some way and linking it up with other data. And we've talked about facial recognition systems, or just of different layers that can be put together to put, to create really a profile of a person and try to predict their behavior and what they're doing and buying and engaging in.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's already crazy where, to the point where you put a photo up on Facebook. And like, for instance, I'll put a photo up of me, my wife, and our child, and the Facebook will say, hey, look at the face of your wife. Do you want to identify this? We know who this is. Mm-hmm. Like Facebook knows who it is. And then they pointed the face of our child and Facebook says, who is this? Tell us who this is. Tag them now. And I want to say, you don't have him yet.
Yeah.
It's not, wait, I'm sure he'll be on there. But, for now, he's outside of your system. He's outside of your panopticon.
Right. Well, and in some ways, he's outside of society, right? Because mm-hmm. if this is what we increasingly continue to do, we indoctrinate one another via our virtual internet presence, then if you're not in that yet, then you are operating outside of society.
Yeah, we've already looked at some commentary before about how the newer generations, the idea of private lives has, to varying degrees, eroded. Mm-hmm. They're more comfortable, by and large, with the idea of just living your life out there on the internet where anyone can see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can imagine a day when it becomes the norm that you're also contributing to this panopticon structure through the information that's streaming through your glasses or whatever kind of personal computing device you're wearing, and then adding to the surveillance information on the society you live in.
Yeah, because I guess the flip side on this is that the more data that's being put out there, the more transparency could occur, right? So I think the positive spin on this would be, okay, so we are collecting an immense amount of data about one another in society, but as a result, perhaps we would have less corruption. We would have less ne'er-do-wellism.
Well, but Foucault would never say that.
He
would never say that is the answer at the end of the
I know.
Equation.
I'm playing devil's advocate and saying someone on the other side of this argument could say, hey, there's a worth in having this amount of data out there, and that there's no way that everyone, all the corporations in the world, all pooled together, could truly analyze the amount of data that comes out of it. That's one argument.
Yeah. It all comes back to what you were saying earlier about the idea that the panopticon is the universe, and the inspector in the tower, in the inspector's lodge, mm-hmm. is God. What kind of God do you end up believing in? Do you believe in a benevolent God mm-hmm. who wants to keep an eye on us and make sure that we're safe in our comfy cells? Is it a complete, benign God that is just sort of watching as we either live comfortably or are horribly beaten in ourselves? Or is it an oppressive God who is there to make sure that we stay in this grim, dirty cell and are only moved according to his, her, its whims?
So that's the problem, is that there's no one God in this situation, right? Depending on where you live and the kind of culture you live in and the politics surrounding it, you could have a benevolent God or you could have a vengeful God.
All right. There you go. The panopticon in a nutshell. Before we close out here, I'm going to call over the mailbot and we're going to do a quick listener mail. All right. This one comes to us from Peter Cron, and who's a longtime listener. And as always, hitting us up with some cool links on our Facebook page and writing us with some cool thoughts. And here's just some wonderful musings that he presented to us. He says, hey there, got something I was thinking about today that maybe either of you two have thought about. I'm wondering about consciousness. So I was reading an article by Carl Zimmer, which had me thinking about what it would be like if our massively connected world developed a real next-level consciousness that its individual components were mostly unaware of. Would this supermind start probing itself like we do with our own brains? Would it at first be as clumsy as our own experiments before we understood our own biology a bit better? I'm thinking that a probe might consist of something like these microscopic fast financial dealings on Wall Street that we've assumed were traders using supercomputers to manipulate the market. Some have said they could be experiments, but by who? How else might our new mind test its own boundaries? It may just realize its consciousness when other similar entities arise from the ether of the internet or communicate somehow. Or it may coerce us into taking to space exploration, drive competition via heightened cybercrime and espionage between countries based on historical knowledge of how to fund these expensive ventures. I'm sure there must be people already doing actual testing to see if this thing is alive.
Man, that just makes me think of the whole conscious problem, like consciousness problem that we've talked about,
mm-hmm.
and how much more difficult that would become, I think, right? Because you're adding another layer onto that.
You're adding a macro layer on top of our existing conundrum of consciousness.
Maybe that's the consciousness that would figure out our consciousness for us.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, you create this godlike, in a way, it ties in nicely with the idea of the Panopticon. If through something like this, if we were able to either create or accidentally create or give birth to a super consciousness mm-hmm. that ends up more or less occupying that center, tower in the Panopticon, what would the effects be? And what would the nature of that entity be? And how might it manipulate the prison to maintain control or to maximize efficiency?
And could it beam out a holographic eye in the sky for us all just to look up and gaze upon?
Well, what is that a reference to?
I just think that it should be, if there's going to be this sort of super consciousness, that it should be able to have these, a symbol of itself to beam out.
Particularly,
if it's going to truly occupy the place of a panopticon.
Well, that's like the Eye of Sauron, right? In The Lord of the Rings that floats over the tower in Mordor.
That's right. It's really the Eye of Providence.
Yeah, really. There's another excellent example of Panopticon right there. All right. So, hey, you want to reach out to us? You want to talk to us about the Panopticon? We would love to hear from you. I mean, specifically, what are your thoughts on the idea that we're living in a Panopticon now? Do you feel like this? Do you feel this sort of fear and paranoia that you may be observed at all times? And how does that affect your behavior? How does that affect your happiness level? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us at all the usual places, especially stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where all the podcast episodes are, the blog posts, the videos, etc. You can also find us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Google+, we're Mind Stuff Show on YouTube. And hey, if any of you are in Cuba or have been to Cuba and have actually visited the prison we were talking about earlier, let us know what that was like. I've seen the photos and they're amazing, but nothing beats a personal visit to something like that.
And if you should be so bold as to craft an email that may or may not be read by others besides Robert and myself, you can do so by sending it to blowthemind@discovery.com. For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene! Run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.